Hi, I'm Sandy, grateful recovering food addict. We are having a major windstorm here right now. So my internet hopefully will hold out okay until I finish speaking. But if there's problems or I freeze or whatever, just wave at me so I know what's happening. Also, because trees are falling. So if a tree falls on my house, I may have to leave early. Anyway. Thank you very much for asking me to speak here. Actually, it was Martine, my good buddy in Brussels, Martine, who tends to hunt me down every now and then and get me to speak at different places. And it's a wonderful time to be in recovery because, you know, I've spoken in Ireland, I've spoken in Israel, I've spoken in Australia, you know, I've spoken in all sorts of places, and yet I've never left my living room. So it's a great gift. So anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope. I don't make notes. I don't pre-plan. I allow my higher power, whom I choose to call God, to just guide me. And whatever is, is. Okay. I truly believe that I was born a food addict, from the get-go. The reason I say that is, when I was 6 weeks old, I had pertussis, whooping cough, nearly died, was in the hospital, was separated from my mom. So heaven only knows, you know, like I'm not going to go into the whole psychosocial thing about I was deprived from my mother and from food and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. But somehow something happened that distorted my thoughts and my need for food. My first binge, Blythe, can I mention food? Okay. My first binge, I remember as if it were yesterday, was at the age of 3 years old. Now, I'm 73, so that's 70 years ago. And yet I remember as if it were yesterday. My mom gave me a banana. I ate the banana and I wanted more. She said no. And she put the rest of the bunch on the counter. And I proceeded to pull over a chair, climb up on the counter, and I ate the rest of the bunch of bananas and then threw up. But I remember, you know, I remember the taste of the initial one, and it's like, oh, I need more. I need more. And having more and just shoving it, you know, just because it, and it had to be secret because my mom said no. So right then and there, my disease of more and my disease of secrecy started at the age of three. And it just continued on. My mom had me when she was, she was old. She was older. She was an older mom. She was 40 when she had me. Now, back then, back in the, you know, 40s, late 40s, that was old. You know, women didn't have babies in their 40s. They had them when they were, you know, they got married out of high school, had their babies and, you know, but my mom was 40 and she was ill. So for me, it set up something in my brain that I was different. All of my friends had moms who were young and active. And I had a mom who was older and ill. And she actually passed away when I was 16. So I was different. And right from the very beginning, I always felt different. I always felt like there was something wrong with me, that there was something that needed to be fixed. And the way I handled that was turning to food, because that uncomfortableness about being me needed to be, that the noise needed to be quieted. I needed to quiet that sound down. And that happened through food. I remember, you know, going to school, then, you know, my mom would give me, you know, lunch money, which wasn't a lot of lunch money back then for, you know, a hot meal, whatever. And I took it and I bought ice cream at school. That's what I had for lunch, ice cream. And on my way home, whatever left over, I stopped and I got more ice cream. And it just, that was it for me. It was all about sugar. Was all about crunchy things. You know, on Saturdays, I would get on my bike and I would ride to the center of town, meet my girlfriend. And the first thing we would stop and get would be two slices of pizza. Then we would go get a quarter of a pound of chocolate almond bark from the candy store. And then we would go get two scoops of ice cream every single Saturday. And it's like, that was nutrition to me. That was food. You know, I would eat whatever food my mom gave me for dinner or whatever, but it was all about the snack food, the sugar, all that stuff, because it made me, it did some, it sedated me. It sedated those feelings inside of me that were screaming, you're not enough. You're not good enough. You're different. I started suffering from depression. And I asked my mom, you know, can I see the school psychologist? You know, because I knew that something was wrong. And she's, oh, no, we don't talk about anything. You know, no, nothing outside this house. So what did I do? I had to stuff it. I had to stuff it down. And that's exactly what I did. I stuffed. And my mom was, as far back as I remember, was always overweight. I always remember her as being fat, you know, so she was fat and she was old in my eyes. And I swore I'd never be like her. When I was 12 years old, she joined this brand new program that had just started called Weight Watchers. And the woman who started Weight Watchers, Jean Neidich, lived in the town that we lived in. We lived on the poor side of the tracks. You know, my dad made minimum wage and, you know, but we lived in a town that was ultra wealthy. And so we went, my mom took me with her. We went to Jean's home, you know, and sat there. And I remember she got the diet, you know, the Weight Watchers, the original Weight Watcher diet was typed out on a piece of onion skin paper. I wish I kept it. I could probably sell it on eBay for $1 million right about now. And, you know, it was a very restricted, strict diet, the initial diet, you know, and she would go once a week to her meetings and weigh in and the whole nine yards. Now, I was always a very skinny little kid. I never had a weight problem. Initially. So I could eat anything, you know, the fact that I lived on sugar, and didn't gain any weight is proof of that. But at 12, skinny little kid, I was decided I was going to go on the Weight Watchers diet because I didn't want to be like my mom. I never wanted to get fat like my mom. So I went on the diet and, maintained that for, you know, years. Then, as I said, she got sicker. And eventually she passed away when I was 16. And I didn't know what to do with those feelings because the feelings I had were feelings of guilt, and shame. I felt terribly guilty with the way I treated my mom because I was, you know, I was comparing her to other moms and she didn't measure up. You know, I was very physically active in school. She couldn't go to my sports events. You know, she couldn't do this. She couldn't do that. You know, and being a snotty teenager, you know, I reacted by, you know, I don't think I was very nice to her. And I just remember I used to go to my friend's house on the weekends. I never stayed home. I didn't want to be home because when I was home, it was at night, me, my dad, my mom sitting on the couch eating ice cream and potato chips every single night. That was the routine. So on the weekends, I needed escape and I escaped to my friends and I tried to pretend like they were my family. So anyway, when she up and died, I didn't know she was dying. Nobody told me. Back in those days, they didn't tell you. I found out by accident. Oh, by the way, you know, your mom passed away in the hospital. And it just sent me spinning. It really sent me spinning. And so, you know what? I didn't even check the time. Okay, there we go. I'm going to speed it up because really it's not about the disease. It's about the recovery for me. So I'm going to speed up. I ended up getting married to someone, a Marine who got killed in Vietnam. And then I got remarried almost right away to the Marine who brought his body back for the funeral, you know, and here I am 19, lost my mom. I'm a widow, remarried. You know, I had one child from my first marriage and then we started having kids of our own. All right. And I'm 19. I've got grandkids now that are that age. And I'm like, oh my gosh, was I a fruitcake? And I was. I suffered terribly from depression and from this disease. And for me, the food is just the symptom. It is not the disease. You know, food was my solution. You know, the problem was life on life's terms that I couldn't deal with. So stuff went on. We had a couple more kids. And when I was in my early 30s, I was on death's door. I could no longer deal with life on life's terms. I'd been handed some pretty heavy stuff. And how did I deal with it? I dealt with it by running away in the food. The food was what, and you know, what I love our 12 and 12, you know, when it talks about the insanity. I was so insane. I was so crazy. I was powerless over the food, but my life was unmanageable. And I was crazy. I did the crazy things like eating out of the trash, driving in a snowstorm to the convenience store so I could spend $20 and eat it all before I got back home. It's amazing I never got into a car accident driving while I'm shoving food into my mouth, hiding the wrappers under the car door. And one, I'll stop with the food stuff right here, because it's just a memory that I it's so clear in my mind. I was pacing in my living room, just back and forth and pacing and pacing. And my husband said to me, "Honey, do you need chocolate?" And I was like, "Yes." And he went to the store, he bought me chocolate. And when he came home, I remember going in the bathroom, because who doesn't eat in the bathroom, ripping it open, shoving it in my mouth. And it felt, now I've never done heroin, but it sounds to me as if the same thing would happen, as if I was injecting heroin into my veins, because that sensation of relief and just, I'm an addict. Okay. Fast forward. So I don't know how I ended up in the rooms of OA. I knew nothing about anonymous programs, nothing at all. Never heard of them. Didn't know anything about 12 steps. None of it. There was no alcoholism in my family. Didn't know anything about it. But somehow I ended up at a meeting. And I remember walking in there and I just knew that I was home. They were talking. I don't remember what was said, but they were speaking my language and they were talking about my disease and they were talking about a solution and hope. And they handed me some pamphlets, you know, and I took them home. I was desperate. I was suicidal. I was desperate. I went home and I turned over the back and there were the 12 steps. And I'm like, this is the answer. So I attempted to do all 12 steps that night. You know, I sat there and I wrote down, you know, everything, because like I had to hurry up because I was dying. And I went to my next meeting and this woman came over and sat down next to me and she says, "You're in trouble, aren't you?" And I was like, "Yes." And she says, "I'm going to be your sponsor." I'm like, "Okay." And she's like, "You're going to go to a meeting every day." I'm like, "Okay." And she could have told me to go jump off a bridge. I would have done it. I would have done anything she told me to do, because she had recovery. She had the hope and I could see it in her. I could hear it in her. And that's what I wanted. That's what I needed. And the funny thing is, you know, we had just moved to Massachusetts and it was in February, or well, it was in September, but I never wore socks. Never. Okay. Never wore socks. And she said to me, "Sandy, you live in New England. You have to wear socks." I'm like, okay, who knew? I was incapable of caring for myself, of self-care, just incapable. Anyway, so I had to do my first, fourth, and fifth step that first week in program. I did steps 1, 2, and 3 immediately because number one, I was powerless over the food, over any substance. My life was unmanageable. I was willing to believe, came to believe that a power greater than me, I believed in God, could restore me. And I was perfectly willing to turn my life over because I was that desperate. And so from there, because what was killing me were the secrets of my life, the shame, the guilt, all the stuff that I had done through my ism that were plaguing me and weighing on me. I had to lance that boil and get rid of that poison. And I did that. I went back to her house that first week and I poured out my heart for 8 solid straight hours and got rid of the worst of it. Okay. And she sat there and goes, "You know,
kinda."
Ooh, gracious. Okay, I'll talk faster. so anyway, that was over 40 years ago. She is still my sponsor today. God bless that woman. She deserves a medal. Anybody that could put up with my insanity for 40 years deserves a medal. Okay, so, but I can't believe I only have 5 minutes to talk about recovery, because recovery is everything. And for me, the recovery is in the steps. It is the steps. It is the solution. It's in the big book. And it's simple. It may not be easy, but it's simple. It's just so simple to just, because it's all about surrender. It's all about surrendering my need for more, my need for perfection, my need to be taken care of. All of that, I need to surrender. And the minute I do, the weight is lifted. And it's a pun, but two kinds of weight are lifted. And, you know, there is today nothing that happens in my life that I can't deal with on a daily basis with my higher power, with my sponsor, with the fellows, with the steps. I live in steps 10, 11, and 12. I do, you know, 10 step. If I make a mistake, you know, gosh, sometimes I make a mistake, or sometimes I say something or whatever, and I have to make an amends. Tomorrow is our wedding anniversary. It'll be 54 years that we've been married. Yeah. Wow. And we were in lockdown together for, you know, now almost 3 years. You know, it's a good thing we like each other, because can you imagine being locked up, you know, in the same place, can't go anywhere, see anybody else for 3 years? So, but that's the miracle. That's the blessing. And it's only because I give myself over every single day. I can't get on my knees because I had a knee replacement, so I can't kneel. But, you know, it's me and God. You know, I do my journaling. I use the tools. You know, I meditate, I journal, I talk, I go to meetings, I do what's asked of me. You know, I say the 11th step prayer, you know, and the promises have come true in my life, you know, one day at a time. And I'm so grateful, you know. So when somebody asked me to speak, because I don't particularly like to speak, you know, it's not something I would like, you know, go stand out of the street corner and say, hey, you know, I'll speak for you. But I was told never say no. Never say no, because I never know what opportunity is going to come up. And I guess it's probably pretty close. So I'm going to wrap that up. I do want to say one thing. I have a hearing disability. I cannot. So I have to read lips. And I will do not put my contact information in the chat. You can direct message me. I'll be happy to do that. But I've had some incidents. So I do it on a private one-to-one basis. But I only can connect through texting or through Zoom, because I have to read lips. And so I think with that, I'm going to wrap it up and say thank you so much for asking me.